You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host. Today, instead of doing an interview with what's going on in our country, indeed the world, in regards to demonstrations and protesters, I thought to protest against not only brutal execution of George Floyd, but against a history of repression and of the taking of civil rights away and of killing by police. You know, the thing is, though, in the past, many Americans have fought for black rights but didn't know anything about or care about the mistreatment of Native Americans, the indigenous people in our country. Today we have the same issue with American Indian tribes. People either don't know or don't care about the Native issues. And there are a number of Native issues to care about. There's the Indian country fact that people in Indian country face higher risk, lack of resources in the COVID-19 fight, especially the Navajos have been suffering greatly. There's the missing and murdered indigenous women. It's a modern-day genocide of Native women. And if you knew anything about the Oklahoma land rush, or that time when white men married Indian women who had land that had oil and gas on it, would then marry the women and murder them for the land and its resources. And Linda Horgan's book, Mean Spirit, is a good way to start for figuring that out. The fact also remains that suicide rates for Native teens are 2.5 times higher than the national average. Native teens have a death rate of 2 to 5 times higher than most whites in the same age group. And what I'd like to do today is talk about why are Indians and Indian tribes treated differently from other Americans. You know, during the course of the 19th century, they had been deprived of much of their land by the westward expansion, and the removal of them from their land by a succession of treaties, which were often not honored by the white authorities and sometimes not even ratified, and if not that, by military defeat by the U.S. when it expanded its control over the American West. And American West at that time, of course, was following the manifest destiny, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. There are a few occurrences here of major events that were important to us understand what I will get to today, which is how the Ute Indians, the native indigenous people of where we live in most of Colorado, what happened to them and where we stand today. You know, the Office of Indian Affairs was started back at the early 1820s, and then it became the Bureau of Indian Affairs in 1947. But let's go back to 1830 when the Indian Removal Act was passed that really institutionalized the practice of forcing Native American Indians off their ancestral lands, their homelands, in order to make way for European settlement. And it was 1831 that Chief Justice of the Supreme Court John Marshall had attempted to define the status of Native peoples. He declared that Indian tribes were, and get this, domestic dependent nations whose relation to the United States resembles, and I quote, that of a ward to his guardian. Marshall was really, in effect, recognizing that America's Indians are unique in that, unlike any other minority, they are both separate nations, sovereign nations, and also a part of the United States. Marshall also really suggests that the federal government has a special obligation to care for Native American populations. But then, as we started seeing more laws passed, the one in 1851 of the Indian Appropriations Act, it authorized the establishment of Indian reservations to put the displaced Native peoples. It started in Oklahoma and inspired the creation of reservations in other states as well. And the U.S. federal government envisioned that reservations would be a useful means of keeping indigenous people off the lands that white Americans wanted to settle. So the Indian reservation system that was created really helped get Native Americans off their land that European Americans desired. The reservation system allowed Indian tribes to govern themselves and to maintain some of their cultural and social traditions. But if you look at the treatment of Native kids in Indian schools, you'll think another thought. The Indian reservation system, besides allowing nations to govern themselves, put people in places that had not many resources. And the good example of that is the Southern Ute Reservation and the Utah Reservation that was now or is now the home of those tribes that lived here, the bands of tribes of Utes that lived here in Colorado. And then President Grant came along and adopted in late 1860s a policy that was aimed at assimilating Native American Indians into mainstream U.S. society. And government officials who oversaw Indian affairs were replaced with Christian clergy, and it was either assimilation or annihilation by the U.S. Army. And much of what General Ulysses S. Grant as president did was give his cronies contracts to supply food and rations to the tribes. And in case of the Utes, a number of railroad cars set at sidings where the beef and the meal went bad, and they never received their rations. Or if they did, it was bad meat and bad meal. Then there was the Dawes Act in 1887 that really destroyed the reservation system by subdividing tribal lands into individual plots, and so a family could have a certain amount of land. And then when the Great Depression hit in the 1930s, President Franklin Roosevelt encouraged the passage of the U.S. Indian Reorganization Act, which instituted a new deal for Native Americans and really gave them, again, the right to reorganize and form their own tribal governments. So we've had a go on again, off again, we'll do this and then we'll do that in terms of trying to manage the in quote-unquote Indian situation. And the act ended the land allotments created by the Dawes Act and thereby resurrected again the reservation system, which remains in place today. Now, in regards to the Ute specifically, they were first encountered by Europeans in 1776 when the Dominguez Escalante expedition was trying to get from Santa Fe, New Mexico to California. And without the Utes to help them as guides, they would never have made it as far as they did. At that time, the Ute homeland was really much of Utah, southern Wyoming, northern New Mexico, and three-quarters of Colorado from the western slope on in particular. It consisted of 9 to 12 confederated bands with an estimated population of about 5,000 people. And the Glenwood Springs area was the Apatika band's territory. And when the pioneers started moving westward, like we'd talked about before, under the flag of Manifest Destiny, that was really based on the doctrine of discovery, that Columbus had a right, or anyone who came with the king's blessing and the blessing of the Pope had a right to claim territory that was inhabited by indigenous people. And that, we know the disaster that created, and there are many places to read about that. Treaties then really were signed in many cases, especially by the Utes, never fully comprehended by those leaders signing them. And since they could not read or write English, they signed with an X. The treaties really eventually reduced the Ute homeland of millions of acres to 2 reservations in Utah and 2 in Colorado. The 2 in Colorado are the Southern Ute Reservation in Ignacio and the Ute Mountain Ute Reservation, which also extends a little bit into Utah. And then there's the Fort Duchesne Reservation, the Uinta Uray Reservation in northern Utah. So when these treaties were signed, they didn't really mean a lot to the folks that were seeking a new tomorrow coming west. And so in the Glenwood Springs area, again, Defiance was the name of the town, original name of Glenwood Springs, because they knowingly were intruding in violation of the Ute Treaty of 1878. And there was a saying that Governor Pitkin echoed and it was the saying of the Utes must go. And newspapers, it was their theme song for years. In 1864, an event happened that everyone in Colorado should really know about. It happened on November 29th, 1864, and it's called the Sand Creek Massacre. If you haven't seen the Rocky Mountain PBS special Colorado Experience, Sand Creek Massacre, you certainly should. The fact that the Utes knew about what happened in the Sand Creek Massacre gives us a bit of understanding, really, of how they responded to the 1879 Milk Creek Battle. And Milk Creek was the northern reservation boundary at that time, near present-day Meeker, and Utes pinned down federal troops. It was one of the longest sieges by any tribe against U.S. cavalry in Western history. Very few people know that. And the best source for information regarding the Utes' removal is called Troubled Trails, a book by Robert Salburnackle. The Utes won the battle but lost the war, and eventually, in 1881, Governor Pitkin got his way when the Utes in our area were forcibly driven to their present-day location and reservation near Fort Duchesne, Utah, violating not only their human rights and dignity, but shooting or leaving for dead those who fell behind. And you don't see that written in history books because, remember, history is written by the conquerors, not the conquered. They were told to never come back, but they did. They came back to hunt, as was their right under the various treaties. What some people don't realize about treaties is they don't give anything to the tribes the treaties are signed with, they take away. And the treaties show what's being taken away, and that which is not mentioned in the treaty, in the case of the Utes, the hunting rights that they had, were still hunting rights under the treaty, but then the game laws of the state of Colorado had a different viewpoint. So when the Utes came in to go hunting in Colorado off the reservation, that trouble occurred. And that's the unfortunate thing about not having treaties rights, really having them violated, rather. Even today, the stories of conquerors and the conquered continue in our nation and in the world with similar complex realities that the Utes had existed of racial and cultural inequity. In America, it's being brought to us face-to-face, over and over, day-by-day, by protest, that we are forced to take notice of and challenge to do something about. Today, the tribes still have their ancient ceremonies. The bear dance is a good example that occurs in the spring. And they also have the sun dance in the summer. The Southern Utes are really, and having been put in a place that didn't seem to have a lot of resources, have really shown up their reservation, drawers of the reservation lines, because they are one of the richest tribes in America, have a credit rating higher than the nation of Japan, have their own casino and natural gas company. Then the Ute Mountain Utes at Towak, Colorado, have also a casino and their farm and ranch enterprise, which after years and years of attempting to get water to irrigate their land, have succeeded in doing so. The problem also that exists today that's still not been taken care of is what can be done about reconciliation with the Ute people for being not really compensated correctly and being driven from their homeland? And there's been attempts by some people, myself included, to try to have reconciliation to the Utes and for what the modern day equivalent would be of being a refugee, essentially on their way to being driven to another place, a desert, basically. But there's a number of people that are trying. The Telluride Institute has a new program called Reflections on Reconciliation. And the program director, a friend of mine, Art Goodtimes, who was for years the reelected each year as a San Miguel County commissioner, says this about Native American legal scholar Walter Echohawk, who has called out five parts to any reconciliation. And Walter Echohawk wrote In the Courts of the Conquerors, an excellent case of the 10 worst Supreme Court cases decided and regarding Native Americans. Carbondale has also dedicated a park called Nooch, after the name that the Utes give themselves. But again, those five things, let's go over them. Paths to Reconciliation by Walter Echohawk is, first, there has to be an incident, and we've just mentioned the incident that happened on the Battle of Milk Creek, and also at that time, the Utes in their uprising killed Meeker, who was the Indian agent, and some of the other men that worked there, and also took captive Nathan Meeker's wife. And again, that is all gone into in really good detail by excellent writing in the book Troubled Trails. Second, it takes an apology, which that's what Art Goodtimes has done with his program, and that's what I believe that the Carbondale folks have done, issued an apology. There's no national apology yet. I don't know if there ever will be for the treatment of indigenous peoples. The third thing is an acceptance of an apology. You know, people nowadays are doing what's called, a lot of different groups are called land recognition. And before they give a talk or have a workshop, they talk about who that land originally belonged to. And that's fine, but that, as a lot of the people would say, what does that do for us? If it makes them feel better giving the recognition, what does it do for us? It's not an apology. It's a recognition, and it has to stay at that. The fourth thing, then, about really doing any kind of reconciliation is reparations are the restitution of some kind, and that has not happened very often. If, and I know of no case that it has happened as far as the Utes are concerned. And then finally, the fifth step is a state of reconciliation. In 2008 and 2009, I was lucky to be part of the Smoking River powwow, in which for 3 years, myself and at that time other Forest Service employees and Clifford Duncan, Elder Northern Ute Elder Clifford Duncan, had made arrangements and had done all the necessary work to have a powwow in Meeker. And the reason for that was to try to attempt a reconciliation of sorts, in the fact that when people were driven out of the Meeker area, when the Utes were taken to the reservation in Utah, they were told to never come back. And the stories that were told of them and passed on through generations were very vivid stories of the people that were herded up and put on the reservation and forced march from Colorado to near Fort Duchesne. If they fell behind, the stories the Utes have told me is they were left for dead or killed. And again, that story has never been told. And that attempt at reconciliation, you can look in two different sources to look at one side that a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor in the July 31st, 2008 edition, Josh McDaniel, said the powwow builds bridges between the town of Meeker and the White River Utes, and he called his article in Colorado Reconciliation for a Displaced Tribe. But if you look at the book Ute Land Religion in the American West, 1879 to 2009, by Brandy Dennison, she presents an attempt at reconciliation that it was not totally successful, and I would have to agree with her having been a part of it. Because the friendships that were established at the two powwows those 2 years didn't produce any significant change at all. And I guess the question is, what do we as individuals do about injustice when we see it, when we're made aware of it? I think many people have the feeling, well, since I wasn't responsible for any of this, why do I have an obligation? And I guess you could ask the same thing of the protests now. If you're not doing the police brutality, then what's it got to do with you? Well, it's got to do with you, the fact that how we treat other people, how we treat other groups of people, tells a lot about who we really are. It tells about what really resides in our heart, is what it does. And when wrongs have been committed, they last for generation after generation. And the victims, I feel, and have been really doggedly trying to find proof of this in science articles and genetic research, I truly feel that violence, when it's perpetrated upon a people, lasts in the generations, for I don't know how many generations, but is passed on in some way. Some people say that it's as a marker on the DNA, but when you look at the descendants of the Sand Creek Massacre, and my wife is one of the descendants, her great-great-grandmother survived the Sand Creek Massacre, and when I talked to the National Park Service folks not long ago about how many people have really been identified that were at the Sand Creek Massacre, it was such a horrendous event that still to this day, only 75% of the people that were there have been identified. And so these events like that, the events of the removal of the Utes from their homeland, are such events that the violence perpetrated at that time continues in even today, and the people that have through their ancestors survived that violence. There's ways that people can try to understand where indigenous people in Colorado are coming from today. They do their ceremonies. As I said, the bear dance and the sun dance are ceremonies that are cultural ceremonies that are passed down, that really an invitation to is something that is really important. If you ever get invited to one of those events, I would suggest you go. And trying to make friends with a group of people that you know nothing about really sometimes requires a sponsor, someone who's willing to help you understand that culture. It takes a decision on your part, however, to want to know more about a group of people you know very little about. And that's my attempt today, is to give you enough background about the Ute people, the Nooch, that you may go forth and read, go forth and try to understand from what's been written, though it's most of it is written by people that are not genetically related to the Ute people, written a lot of times by white people, but there's still events that happen and facts of history that will lead you to understand a vast proportion of what has happened in a way that will cause you, I think, to have a change of heart if you know nothing at all and wish to try to understand the indigenous people who lived and was their land where we are today. One way to do that is to visit the tribal headquarters, to try to go to Ignacio and realize that's a tri-Ute culture there. The Hispanics and the Utes and the white folks are living in fairly decent harmony. It's not always that case in other places, but there are economic disadvantages also to indigenous people, as well as health issues. The health issue that is really evident for a lot of Native peoples is diabetes, because when we introduced sugar into their culture that they had never known before, and they then were not eating their native diet, it has wreaked havoc among Native peoples, and the Utes are no exception. The best thing I think we can do is try to have an understanding of cultures that have been disadvantaged on purpose, that have been subjected to bias and bigotry. And I challenge you to do that for yourself about the Ute people. And that's my desire in terms of trying to make sense of today's protest and what's happening today. It's my attempt to make sense of that. Appreciate you being with us today and listening. Tune in to our next show, Tuesday, July the 14th at 4:30, when we'll talk with best-selling author Peter Heller. Until then, whatever you do, do it to Mother Earth for land's sake.